Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. It's not hard to look at Ohio's energy policy over the last two decades and wonder, what happened? Especially as today's energy needs surge, driven by power-hungry data centers and an anticipated population boom. Finding enough resources for the future is the challenge. Those who favor renewable sources like solar and wind say Ohio was once a leader, until money and politics changed that. Some who favor fossil fuels and nuclear energy say it's time to embrace an above-all approach when it comes to solutions. Today, we're talking about the state of energy in Ohio, the basis of a three-part series from WOSU News. Joining us now is Katie Genius, who reported on the topic for WOSU Public Media, along with Renee Fox. Thanks for joining us today, Katie.
Well, thanks for having me.
So your series gives us an overview of energy policy in the state over the last two decades. So I wanted to start there. Can you give listeners kind of a legislative recap? I know a legislative recap of 20 years sounds like a lot, but maybe a little recap.
Yeah. So what started was former Governor Republican Bob Taft had an energy action plan in 2006 that kind of outlined some renewable things that was really built upon in 2008 by Democratic Governor Ted Strickland. His goal was 25% renewable energy to be, or 25% of Ohio's renewable energy to be 25% generated, to be generated within state. So 25% of all of our energy generated within the state come from renewable sources by 2025. And then what happened is Strickland left office. And so almost immediately after that, we see Kasich come in that allows new like funding, new regulatory gaps, not gaps, but new subsidies for things like fossil fuels, things like fracking. Fracking had a huge boom in Ohio around 2012 to 2014. And then you start to see things like a setback rule get changed. That was for wind turbines. It's how far away a wind turbine can be from a property line. But with that, you start to see renewables come like vaguely under attack in Ohio of things getting set back. You have to be farther away from a property line. You have to be have some more regulatory hurdles. And then you get things like House Bill 6, which really change our renewable standards. It changed that 25% that I mentioned before to just about 8.5% and extends the timeline to 2026, really focuses on coal and nuclear with that bill. If anyone is familiar with that scandal, that's just about what it was about. And then we also see things like Senate Bill 52, which allows Ohio counties and townships to ban solar projects.
Right.
Which they can't do for fossil fuel projects like natural gas or fracking, oil, anything like that. But they can ban renewables, which a lot of places that renewables are very favorable for, so large agricultural areas tend to have people who are ideologically opposed to renewables kind of stunting a lot of that growth in Ohio.
Yeah, so let's bounce back to 17 years ago. Both Republicans and Democrats agreed, and they had a clean energy bill. And the goal was renewable resources generated 25% of the state's electricity by 2025, as you mentioned. So that bill was signed into law in 2008, and it was signed by then Democratic Governor Ted Strickland. You interviewed him for this series that you did, and he reflected on the significance for your series.
I think Ohio was on the verge of really emerging as a major national leader in the production of wind and solar and other forms of energy that were better, much better for the environment.
So the idea of renewable energy, which is sometimes called clean energy, wind and solar being the crux of that, it seemed like lawmakers on both sides of the aisle liked it and wanted to embrace it back then. Is that true? Was it more liked by more people a while ago?
Well, the ultimate vote for that bill only had one no vote throughout the Ohio House and Senate. Hmm. So it was a pretty unanimous bill. There was some pushback originally of, we don't want subsidies for renewables. We don't want renewables getting special favor, which was what we heard was kind of some of the initial pushback. But what Ted Strickland did was, this was around the beginning of the recession. Mm-hmm. So he also attached it to making jobs and making sure mm-hmm. that manufacturing of solar panels would happen in Ohio. So that brought a lot of people who were a little more resistant to the idea of renewables on board to support this bill of, well, if we make sure those jobs associated with renewables remain in Ohio, then this is going to be a good thing, which got a bunch of people on board. The people that did not get on board pretty explicitly were the utility company First Energy.
Right. Which is a name we know well now. But the idea of this bill from the Strickland administration, Ohio was positioning itself to be a national leader when it came to solar and wind and that kind of thing. And so for a time it was, right?
Yeah. In 2010, Ohio climbed to second in the country in solar manufacturing. Mm-hmm. We were behind, I think, Oregon. And if you think about solar manufacturing, you think probably about West Coast, more hippie liberal kind of politics, but Ohio was second. And then at one point, we even were first in the country for new solar projects that were going in our state. And that was one of the things that made us want to look into this in the first place, is you go down just kind of an outline of Ohio's like accolades with this, and then you see 2010, we're second in the country. 2011, we're ranked first in the country in another segment. And that was something that my co-writer Renee and I were really excited, really confused about, because that's not the Ohio we currently know.
Mm-hmm.
And so
you asked the question, what happened?
Well, what happened yeah. in 2010 to 2014?
Right. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about WOSU's State of Energy series with reporter Katie Genius. You can find the three-part series at our website, WOSU.org. So let's talk a little bit about what happened. In 2012, we had a new governor, Republican Governor John Kasich. He signed a bill promoting hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking, which is very well known now. But how did that development and the technological advances set a different course for the state?
Yeah, so kind of going back to the election of that, which was in 2010. So that January, Supreme Court makes a decision called Citizens United. It's very infamous now. It creates super PACs. With that comes a lot of new money into politics. It is well believed now that that has fundamentally shifted how politics are done in our entire country. Kasich was the darling of a couple of these different super PACs that has come. He came from, the Lehman Brothers. He was a representative, went to work in the private sector, and then came back and was willing to work with some of these big corporate interests. That, coupled with the huge crash of 2008, had already happened. Kasich is able to kind of pin Ohio's feeling of economic struggle a bit onto Ted Strickland. Ted Strickland is kind of blamed for economic policies. He does not win re-election. And it's pretty much without Strickland there to protect his bill, the Ohio governorship, the Ohio House, and the Ohio Senate all flip to Republican. And they are less interested in protecting a renewable bill, especially because during the recession, the price of oil and gas skyrocketed.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused a lot of technological advancement trying to happen of, well, how do we get more oil and gas for cheaper? Intro this new fracking technology called horizontal hydraulic fracturing,
right,
which allows you to drill sideways instead of putting in a new wellhead. Drill sideways or drill multiple angles off of one wellhead. So in Ohio, around half of the state is covered in shale. Mm-hmm. So we are prime real estate for fracking wells.
And more companies wanted to move into Ohio. That's something the Kasich administration embraced.
Yes. Well, mm-hmm. he has ties financially also to the Koch brothers, mm-hmm. who have one of their many industries has been in oil and natural gas. It is worth saying that Kasich was not like the spearhead of this. We mm-hmm. tried to interview him. His people did not get back to us multiple times, mm-hmm. but he has gone on record, at least in 2012, and then also currently, in as recently as 2020, I've seen, he did an op-ed for Time and saying, hey, we can't get rid of renewable energy. We need to protect our environment. We need to protect our earth. And then also then runs it up with the caveat of, but we can't ignore the business of oil and fracking.
That's why you hear a lot nowadays of this, all of the above approach. There's a lot of lawmakers now who are in favor of fossil fuels. They're in favor of nuclear energy, but they agree that solar and wind are fine, but they say we need it all to meet our energy needs. Did you hear that in your series?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Kasich is actually the first place we heard an all of the above approach. And then we talked to Representative Adam Holmes, which you're having on later, that he is like, we need every watt of electricity that we can get. And that was said in an Ohio House Energy Committee meeting. And that is because of data centers,
yes.
mainly. Columbus is the fastest growing data center city in the country. From 2020 to 2025, we had an increase of something like 1,800%. And we're getting more data centers than anyone else, and data centers are very energy intensive.
Yes, and the state has a push also to be known as the Silicon Heartland, so it's not just data centers, but it's projects like Intel.
Yes.
I mean, everything needs more energy to run all of that. Part of the series, you also talk about the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, which is known as the PUCO, and their role in making sure that consumers are not on the hook for all of this power that these huge data centers need. All the big tech companies coming in, the PUCO needs to make sure that consumers aren't on the hook. Is that happening? Is that working? Are consumers on the hook at the moment?
We don't know yet. That is one of the things that is very frustrating about data centers, is because the rise and prevalence of them is relatively new. Like, we've had data centers before, but these are massive. These are warehouses full of servers that just run 24/7. And we don't know how much energy they're using. They've been pretty tight-lipped about that. There was actually reporting by a Business Insider that tried to get some of those like numbers. And at least a couple data centers, even here in Ohio, returned Freedom of Information Act requests just completely redacted. Mm. So the PUCO did just adopt a new ruling. It's called an energy tariff, and that is different than the tariffs that have been in the news recently. The new ruling allows, AEP was lobbying for this, and says there can be separate rates for data centers. And then you can also charge data centers for a percentage of electricity that they estimate that they'll use. So data centers have been coming to energy companies saying, we're thinking we're going to use X amount of electricity, and they actually use less than that sometimes. Well, the energy company has freed up X amount of electricity for the data center to use. And if they don't use that electricity, then the energy company is kind of left holding the bag. And the thing they kind of want to do is pass that cost around, and because they need to recuperate funds somehow. They are a business. With that, with this new ruling, this allows AEP and other energy utilities to charge data centers for the estimations they give in. So I think it's up to 80% of estimated energy usage. So it's not passed on to the consumer. So we don't know how effective that is yet. I think it was ruled just in September.
Right. It's one of those time will tell kind of things. Yes. Yes. And one final thing before I let you go. You mentioned that there were changes in clean energy law. You know, Governor Kasich kind of, whenever he came in, he didn't want to enforce some of the things that Strickland had signed into law 6 years earlier. And you mentioned... you mentioned a setback rule related to wind turbine projects. So basically, it made it harder to have wind power generated here in Ohio. There's less places to put the wind turbines because of this new rule that was put in place. So basically, it made it not tenable to keep them here in Ohio. Is that basically what happened?
Yeah. So the original rule was it was 1.1 times the height of a wind turbine. So that isn't... that isn't too far. It would be around 550 feet. The new setback rule, which was snuck into a budget bill in 2014, kind of a last minute amendment. We don't even know who snuck it in. It's pretty hard to tell. About triples that. It gives a base of around 1,200 feet plus the height of the, or plus the length of the blade.
So it's hard to find a place to put these wind turbines now. So companies aren't going to come here and build them if they don't have an easy place to put them.
When talking about that, the former head of the Ohio Air Quality Development Authority, Mark Shanahan, and also Strickland's energy advisor, estimates the state lost $5 to $7 billion because of that setback rule.
Wow. All right. And then you also mentioned that another change was made was that municipalities are allowed to say no to solar projects, but they don't have the ability to say no to something like a fracking project, but they can, you know, take a vote against a solar project.
Yeah. And Ohio, WSU has covered that extensively in some of our reporting of different solar projects that have been voted against, bans that have been put in townships. All that stuff, that has been one of the biggest hurdles in recent years to getting new solar projects put in.
All right. So that is what happened to solar and wind here in Ohio. I want to thank you for your reporting on this series. We've been talking with Katie Genius, who did reporting for WOSU's State of Energy series alongside Renee Fox. Katie, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
And you can find all three parts of the series at WOSU.org. Coming up, what is clean energy anyway? And the definition is not as clear-cut as you think. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. It's not hard to look at Ohio's energy policy over the last two decades and wonder what happened, especially as today's energy needs surge, driven by power-hungry data centers and an anticipated population boom, and the state's push to be known as the Silicon Heartland. Finding enough resources for the future is a challenge. We're talking this hour about the state of energy in Ohio, based on a three-part series from the WOSU News team. Joining us now is Associate Professor Jeff Balicki. He is the Associate Faculty Director of Research at Ohio State University's Sustainability Institute, and he also serves as a research lead for energy there. Welcome to All Sides, Jeff.
It's great to be here.
So how do you define the term clean energy? I know you like to stay away from the terms clean and dirty, but for general purposes of this conversation, how is it defined, clean?
Yeah, so typically people refer to clean energy when you're talking about the electricity generating unit and whether or not it emits things. So, for example, coal and natural gas emit carbon dioxide, particulates, and so on, whereas wind and solar, when they're operating, when the wind turbine is spinning, when the sunlight is being absorbed in the solar panels, they don't emit anything to the air.
What is the difference between using the term clean and using the term renewable?
Often clean and renewable are considered to be synonymous. There is a a nuance in that a lot of us who study and are deeply intimately aware of energy technologies, energy systems, and so on, understand that while we're not emitting carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases when wind and solar is operating, we do need to take care of and address the carbon dioxide emissions from other facilities, from natural gas, from coal, from cement manufacturers, from oil refineries, and so on. And so clean tends to encompass the use of devices on power plants that would capture these greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, and so forth, and isolate that from being emitted to the air. So renewable is typically a subset of clean.
Okay. And where does nuclear power fit into this? Because is that clean or is that dirty?
Well, you're asking some great questions. So nuclear does not emit greenhouse gases when it's operating. The construction of a nuclear power plant takes a lot of cement. There's a lot of greenhouse gases that are emitted during the construction and the materials that go into the construction. It is often, it's sort of a gray zone. It's often considered to be cleaner than coal and natural gas, precisely because of those emissions that are not occurring. But then you have to think about the nuclear waste, the radioactive waste that needs to be handled and after the fact. And so it's a little more nuanced there.
So is it clean-ish?
I'd say clean-ish.
I know you're gonna hate that term even more, right?
Well, it's a spectrum, and I tend to not think in absolutes or address things in absolutes. So it's not clean versus dirty. It's cleaner versus dirtier. Mm. And along that spectrum, you can situate coal and natural gas on the less clean side. You can situate nuclear somewhat in the middle and wind and solar somewhat towards the cleaner side.
So you work for the Sustainability Institute. What do you study when it comes to energy? Like, what is your focus? I guess that's another word for us. We're talking clean, renewable, dirty, sustainable now.
Yeah. So the Sustainability Institute, it seeks to drive solutions to critical society and community challenges through research, education, living labs, and partnerships. My role at the Sustainability Institute for several years has been a research lead for energy. And in that role, I work with a lot of faculty to come up with proposals for funding to develop knowledge that helps to transition our energy system to cleaner reliance on cleaner sources of energy. In the new role, the associate faculty director, I'll have a larger purview over more than one bucket within the Sustainability Institute, the energy bucket being mine historically, but now it expands a little bit.
Looking at the energy sources, the U.S. Energy Administration in 2024 listed Ohio as one of the top 10 natural gas producers in the nation. How has Ohio achieved this level of production? We just have a lot of shale, right?
Yeah, we do have a lot of shale. And Katie in the segment before us referred to hydraulic fracturing and Ohio's role in it. And the shale revolution was actually instigated in the 2005 Energy Policy Act at the federal level that exempted hydraulic fracturing from regulation under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Mm. So the technology was there, the telemetry, the horizontal drilling, and so on was there to do the hydraulic fracturing quite efficiently. It was this removal of this policy that allowed it to go forward. So when those of us who study energy, we make the distinction between resources and reserves. Mm. Ohio has long been a fossil fuel producing state, mm-hmm. coal, natural gas, and oil. Shale is a new resource, it's a resource that's always been there. The oil and the natural gas have been there for millions of years. Mm. When it becomes economically extractable, then we refer to it as a reserve. And so the oil and gas in shale deposits, which tend to be pretty thin layers of rock, became economically extractable about 15 or so years ago, in part due to the removal of the exemption under the Safe Drinking Water Act and other policies. So with shale development, what the operators do is they drill vertically, and then they're able to steer the well horizontally, and they can do multiple laterals off of one vertical well, and those laterals can go out a mile or more. Mm-hmm. And it allows them to really produce at great scale from one singular well head at the surface a lot of natural gas. And here in the Appalachian region, eastern Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, we have a lot of these, a lot of natural gas in the Utica and Marcellus Shale.
And you mentioned coal. I mean, the state is the nation's 13th largest producer in, is it bituminous? Bituminous coal.
Yeah.
And the 16th largest coal producer overall.
Yeah.
So coal used to be king, but have technological advances, regulations made coal over the years a safer option? Or are we, is it, they used to use the term clean coal. I bet you hate that term too.
Well, yeah, clean coal typically refers to capturing the carbon dioxide from the stack gas. So, coal has been on a pretty precipitous decline in terms of our reliance on it for electricity generation and other things and basically natural gas has shoved it aside.
Right.
We've been building a lot of natural gas power plants in part because of the availability of cheap natural gas from hydraulic fracturing here in the state and elsewhere. Right now, about 55% of our electricity comes from natural gas power plants. Only about a quarter, 25% of our electricity comes from coal-fired power plants. When you combust coal, there are a lot of byproducts, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and so on, that we do have controls on to keep from, to limit the amount that gets emitted into the air. And affects the people living nearby. So has coal become safer? I think as with most technologies, the more we use it, the more we become experienced with it, the safer it gets. I wouldn't say that it wasn't safe. I would say that the emissions are a problem, and we need to be sure to take care of those emissions to avoid global climate change, but also to avoid the regional health impacts that occur from breathing in the pollutants that coal and some natural gas power plants emit.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about energy needs in Ohio with Ohio State Associate Professor Jeff Bolicki. When it comes to human health, which energy source of all the ones we've been listing here is considered the safest?
Well, again, it's a matter of degrees. When a wind turbine operates, when the blades are spinning, there are no emissions that can affect human health. Now, there are reports of people being stressed out by potential noise, by seeing it, by being in the flicker. If the sun is setting and you're behind and you're in the shadow and that flicker, that can really mess with you. understandably, this constant strobe light. Solar photovoltaics don't have that issue, and they produce electricity when the sun is shining. A lot of people think that here in Ohio, we're not like Arizona, where it's a little gray.
It's a little grayer,
but we do have enough solar radiance to be a good place to locate solar.
Even on a gray day, there's sun somewhere.
So you can still get sunburnt on a cloudy day.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah.
So you can still generate electricity on a cloudy day. You can't really generate it during the night when the sun's not out, but that's where energy storage comes in. And so in terms of safer or healthier, the more renewable energy technologies overall are quite understood to be safer for human health. And that's one of the things that we really need to be sure that we consider. You know, in Ohio, or nationally, about 65% of the energy we use for our economy is undermining the environment and the human health that goes into our well-being. Now, our well-being depends on the economy and our human health. And so understandably, people focus on the economy. But the human health is critical, right? Mm-hmm. While 65% of the way we use energy for the nation undermines the environment, in Ohio, it's 80%. 80% of the energy we use for our economy is emitting greenhouse gases and criteria air pollutants that undermine environmental and human health.
Ohio's energy policy over the last 20 years has gone from embracing renewables to retreating from them in favor of more fossil fuels, as we've discussed. Will we be able to meet current and future demands if we remain on this course?
This
all of the above approach?
Yeah, that's going to be tricky. You know, the Ohio Business Roundtable earlier this year released an energy competitiveness report. And in the report, it projects a 50% increase in electricity and peak electricity demand within 7 years for Ohio, going from about 31 gigawatts now to 47 or so gigawatts within 7 years. That is the growth prior to considering these large, intense data centers and other energy demands. That's about 14 gigawatts of growth just due to those large loads when projected was on the order of 1 to 2 gigawatts. Mm. So here in Ohio, meeting that demand will be challenging, especially given the siting restrictions that Katie referred to in the prior segment. Now, Ohio is situated in what's called the PJM region, Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland, about a dozen states or so in a regional electricity grid. The country is partitioned into several regional electricity grids. I believe it's about 10. Now, and that allows electricity to flow across states within the region, within those electricity grids, and also across electricity grids. In that report from the Ohio Business Roundtable, they look at projections for demand within the PJM region, again, the region in which Ohio is situated, and they're projecting a shortfall of electricity generating capacity within the next few years. Hmm. So whereas now we can meet the demand, the projections are pretty soon we won't be able to.
The idea of caring about Ohio's energy landscape kind of came to light because of the House Bill 6 scandal and its fallout. It brought an intense public focus on Ohio's energy landscape. People probably never cared what First Energy was doing until all of this happened. So in WOSU's State of Energy series, Democratic Representative Tristan Rader, a ranking minority leader on the House Energy Committee, he talked about what changed.
Because I think there's this new willingness to push back. The utilities have gone way too far for way too long, and we need to make sure that we represent the people that live in our districts that deserve protection and deserve that these, you know, monopoly utilities be held accountable.
What do you make of that statement? Do you think that the state is pushing back more whenever it comes to, you know, the average person needing to care about energy policy?
Yeah, well, I think that the pendulum is swinging back towards a deeper and more profound consideration for the electricity that we need. We expect that when we flip on a switch, the electricity will be there.
Right.
And while, you know, utilities and so on can get bad raps, they are the ones that are providing electricity for us. And we definitely, you know, when a power outage occurs, they become top of mind, right? But we are very fortunate that we don't have a lot of these interruptions, mm-hmm. right? And so I'm not sure if it's, you know, I think that we should always care about where our energy comes from, especially how we use energy. You know, when you're cooking in your house, if you have a gas stove, you're burning a fossil fuel right there where you live and you sleep, and importantly, your children sleep, and that's emitting methane and formaldehyde and other emissions into the air we breathe. And when you think about it in that local indoor environment, and then you extrapolate that to a whole regional grid and a regional electricity system, Understandably, that the people who live near power plants that emit stuff might have more health concerns. And so we should care about the energy. We tend to focus on cost, but there's also the human cost and the health cost, not to mention the environmental cost that goes along with it.
Last question before I let you go. If you were able to convince Ohio lawmakers to do one thing going forward, what would it be?
I think it would be to give fair consideration to all types of energy generation facilities now and with the eye towards transitioning away from those that we know and have been proven to have deleterious environmental and human health effects. So some people refer to an all-in strategy. You know, we do need to have a portfolio and various types of electricity generators on the system so that we can meet the supply can meet the demand at all points in time. Otherwise, when you turn the lights, when you flick the light switch, you don't have electricity. But we also so we do need to think about what we have and how we can make what we have more environmentally and human health beneficial. Make it, to use the term, cleaner, while looking forward and allowing ourselves to build the wind and the solar that we know does not have those operational emissions. I would also say that we need to be very serious about electrifying our home appliances. Like I mentioned, the gas stove in your house. When you electrify water heaters, furnaces, stoves, you're moving, if there are emissions associated with that electricity, you're moving that from being within your house. You're not combusting natural gas in your house. It might be combusted at a power plant where it's centralized. We can have the controls on it to take care of some of those emissions. I would say that I would agree with the assessment that Ohio a couple decades ago was pretty much near the vanguard of energy policy in enabling this transition towards more environmental and human health conscious energy technologies. And I think we need to get back to having that mindset.
That's Jeff Balicki, Associate Professor and Research Lead at Ohio State University's Sustainability Institute. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to be talking to the Republican chairman of the House Energy Committee on the state of energy in Ohio and the path forward. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. How will today's energy policy decisions meet the twin challenges of tomorrow? Rapid population growth and an exploding power-hungry tech sector. We're talking this hour about the state of energy in Ohio. It's based on the three-part series from the WOSU Newsroom. And joining us now is the Republican Representative Adam Holmes. He's the chair of the House Energy Committee. Welcome to All Sides, Representative Holmes.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here, and thank you for the work you do.
Yeah. Thank you. So you have been quoted as saying you're in favor of an all-of-the-above approach when it comes to energy policy. So what do you think an all-of-the-above approach looks like?
What I think is certainly we recognize that certain energy sources are the most efficient and economic ways to produce energy in certain environments and regions. So it's incumbent on us to make sure we're open-minded about where we draw our energy from, because it really is situation-specific how we use it.
So there's been, you know, the series that WOSU did was a three-part series on energy policy. And basically the focus was that 20 years ago, a bill was signed into law that said more renewable energy, 25% of the state's energy generation should be renewable by 2025. So then the year hit 2025, and the reporters were basically like, what happened to that? So how do you feel about this backing away from solar and wind and leaning more toward natural gas and fracking?
I think that that transition really represents some demonstrated advantages to going back to the traditional fossil fuels for our state. Mm-hmm. And it's often portrayed as being anti-wind and solar, but I just simply just don't think that's the case. Because as I said before, solar and wind do have applications and can be advantageous in certain environments and situations. But I think what we're recognizing is for our geographic advantages here in Ohio, our logistics and infrastructure development that already exists. The fossil fuels, specifically natural gas, is really an advantage for us for energy production.
How is the House Energy Committee working to meet the future growth? We're a growing region, especially in Central Ohio, where there's more and more data centers gobbling up power and water. How is your committee in the House working to make sure there is enough energy to meet this growing need?
The first thing we did was House Bill 15 that was signed by the governor earlier this year, almost completely unanimous on both sides of in both chambers and by both parties to really incentivize new generation in the state. And that was the first one, is creating a climate where those that have the capital to do that will come to and base their generation in Ohio. That's number one. The second is to return the energy sector to a market-driven arena as much as we can. We really have recognized historically that market forces increase quality and decrease price. So to make it more competitive in that manner, that's really improved the situation for us here. And the third is to standardize how we protect the ratepayers and how we handle the energy rate cases and manage that regulation to expedite it, to make it faster and, again, more efficient to meet the growing demand that's clearly on its way for all of us.
Yeah, the part of House Bill 15 created a new solar energy loan fund for public schools. So public schools will be able to install solar panels, I guess, basically on the school roof. So is this a pivot to maybe leaning more back into solar like we had started to back in 2008?
I think maybe not so much as that, but also recognizing that's a good example of where maybe if we're not doing anything else, we can use that money to generate more power. We can use that money for more power generation for schools. We're looking at some very interesting ideas that have come up where warehouses and other large roof-surfaced buildings rent out their rooftops for solar. And we've had some companies talk to us, and they're, again, adding more electrons to the grid. In a case like that, where you're not even using any more surface area of Ohio, there's a lot of logic to that. So that's an exciting way to look at solar also.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Representative Adam Holmes, the Republican chair of the House Energy Committee. The House Energy Committee is currently discussing another bill. This bill would allow something called the Community Energy Project. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, ma'am. The idea is that communities, again, could gather their resources, whether their own rooftops or local areas, and create their own solar energy system and their grid and use that power as subscribers to this cooperative. Really is what it is, and sell that power back to the grid. And what we like about that idea is that there are times where we really have peak demand, hot summer days in the afternoon, some of the coldest days in January and February, where that could really come into play to reduce those peak demand periods and reduce cost for everybody. So that is in the House committee right now, looking at making sure we do that the right way.
One thing that came up previously that you know, has been the source of some debate is that in Ohio, you as a community, you can vote against a solar project coming into your backyard, basically. But you can't vote against natural gas or fracking coming nearby. What do you make of that, where the community can step up and vote for one thing related to energy, but not the other?
I'd say and this has been unique with solar. Wind to some extent, but even more solar, is appreciating, acknowledging there's a cosmetic change to the environment, to the geography and the environment where you live. And that had a lot of impact on a lot of folks, especially in the rural areas, who liked a more bucolic setting, and it can really transform a landscape into something way more mechanical and urban. And so we wrote language that allowed more local control. That's another Ohio historical theme and value. And we've seen response from communities in Ohio that it really has mattered to them, and they have delayed or stopped solar development projects.
Do you feel if the fracking is not as ugly as the solar panels then?
I don't know about me, but apparently they do.
Yeah.
And I know the if they do it the right way, a fracking site, the square footage on the surface is a lot smaller than a solar grid. But again, different local communities weigh that, and that's been a very unique Ohio facet of our energy process. Clearly, the mineral rights for property owners, that is something that can be very beneficial to families that own property. And so I think support for those fracking sites in local communities, it gets supported more often than not, that kind of development.
And so I guess we're leaning more toward putting solar panels on roofs is what you're saying, because the building's already there, so we might as well stick the panel up on top. Nobody will see it anyway, right?
Right, and we're not using any more land. That is an exciting idea. But we've also looked at some of the brownfields, and those are unfortunately we've polluted areas that can't be used for any other positive use. So let's put energy on those. And back to your original question of all the above, solar panels there make a lot of sense because it's not damaging anything else. And then we've seen a lot of interesting ideas in urban settings, where, again, solar panels in an urban environment might be the very best use of a lot or a field that otherwise has no utility to the community.
For WOSU's Energy Series, they talked with Mark Shanahan, former head of Ohio Air Quality Development Authority, and he served under former Governor Strickland when the 2008 law was passed. He reflected on Republican legislative retreat from renewables in the last decade. Let's listen.
This could have all been implemented already. You could have achieved all these things already. It's very frustrating how far ahead we could be.
What do you make of that? Because basically in 2010, Ohio was like second in the nation for wind and solar. And now we've dropped down into the 40s. Do you feel like we lost some time there?
Well, I think we should have reduced our support for specific energy sources way earlier than we did. And that's where we corrected. Again, all the above and make it a market. We can all agree that wind and solar have substantial drawbacks with their intermittency and unreliability, very dependent on weather and certainly where the sun is. And that doesn't always work. And with this growing demand that we're certainly facing, as we've discussed before, baseload, reliable, sustainable, 24/7, 365 energy is mandatory for these new applications. So unfortunately, in many cases, as we developed wind and solar energy sources, it didn't reduce the demand that we had for those kinds of baseload, reliable, dispatchable energy sources. I think to create the environment that we're trying to do right now, I wish we had done that sooner. Mm.
Do you feel like the fracking, the shale that we have under Ohio, will it be around long enough? Because I know parts of Western Pennsylvania have kind of, they started this before we did, and they've run out, right? So it's not a never-ending source, right?
As I understand it, from the folks that have talked to me, is there's more than they ever thought. Mm. And so you've heard of the Marcellus and the Utica mm-hmm. shale sources, and There's a lot more to the west. Most of it right now, as you know, is in eastern Ohio, but there's the Utica Shale moves west, even towards Columbus, which someday we could look at. But maybe even more important is instead of the natural gas resources as above the oil, that's even more. And so I think someone told me that this region of Ohio, West Virginia, Pennsylvania were the second largest producer of natural gas in the world. And as their technology develops, they're finding more and more. So I think we have a reliable source of that energy for decades, many decades to come, and even centuries.
Okay. I'm sorry to ask you this with less than a minute left, but after the House Bill 6 scandal, there hasn't really been significant legislative reform. Is there anything you can do from the House Energy Committee related to legislative reform when it comes to these big utility companies?
Yes, ma'am. And there again, for your listeners and for all, House Bill 15 that was signed this year, transformational, recognizing House Bill 6, correcting it was a major piece of that. One reason why it was voted unanimously in a bipartisan way to reduce trust and confidence in the energy sector in Ohio. We have a new public utilities commissioner. Her name is Director Jennifer French, has my complete trust and confidence, as she was a Supreme Court judge before she came over, appellate judge, building the right way and looking towards the future of rock and roll. I think Ohio is going to be the heart of it all when it comes to energy in the United States. We should all look for that.
We've been talking with Representative Adam Holmes, the chair of the House Energy Committee. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
And you can find all three parts of WOSU's State of Energy series at WOSU.org. This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.